How was that? Was that good?
That little
little mucus. It's what's for breakfast.
Oh, man, as you get older, Jeffrey, you know all about
this.
I
do.
You hit this stage decades ago.
I do. It's sad but true. Okay, it is Tuesday, July 19th.
Yep.
19th of July. this is on Taking Pictures. Bill Wadman in New York, Jeffrey Sidoris in D.C. We're going to talk about photography and creativity and stuff. Hey, would you give me a little rope here for a sec?
I will, yes.
I think this will play around. I think this will, you know, come back around. But it's, as I mentioned earlier, it's my birthday on Thursday. And every year for the past several years, I, as many of you probably do who listen or are listening or have listened, I kind of take stock of the previous year and do sort of a mental postmortem, if you will, on what happened, what went right, what went wrong. And although these things are in quotes.
Yeah.
And this past year, not calendar year, but you know, the past 12 months or so has been a time of massive change.
Right.
Arguably the most massive change in my adult life.
Right.
And I wanted to talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about getting out of our own way, learning to get out of our own way, learning to recognize opportunity, and what can happen when you are open to that. When I was growing up, my mom used to have this saying, as maybe many of your parents or siblings or whatever, this saying, let go and let God.
Okay.
And I always understood it. I understood what she meant by it, but I always felt that it was a little off in that it absolves you of responsibility. Yeah. I just have to give everything over to God and trust that it's going to be all right.
Okay.
And I think it's on the right track, but I think you still need to steer the ship. You can trust that there's going to be land on the other side of the ocean, but you still need to steer.
Okay.
And one of the things that I think has been core to the last year is the idea of putting myself in the path of opportunity, or putting myself in opportunity's way, and being sort of present enough to be open to changing my life.
Right.
You and I talked a lot a year ago, even more than we know. I mean, we talk a lot anyway, but we talked, I think, more. And I mean, at the time, you pretty much agreed with me that I was clinically depressed.
Right.
For that last time in California. And I think that sometimes you have to get to that point where on the one hand, you do have to let go, but on the other hand, you have to be willing to land where it is that you're going to land. And I found it, for whatever reason, I found it very hard to get out of my own way. I knew what I wanted out of my life, or I thought I did. Maybe that was the big thing. I didn't know what I wanted.
I think that's the hard part.
Yeah. But I think you have to have a couple things. You have to have a presence of being willing to make the change. And then I think you have to have the right support system around you.
I had a conversation last week with a friend of mine, and we were sitting there, and he actually, we are both non-religious people, but he brought up that whole, I guess they call it the serenity prayer.
Sure.
You know, the...
Sure.
You know, Give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage mm-hmm. to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I think it's a little bit what you're talking about, right? It's like
it's exactly what you're, and whether you're talking about moving or leaving a job or starting a new job or getting married or having a kid or whatever it is, there has to be some trust, there has to be some faith, but there also has to be, I think, a willingness to give yourself permission to steer.
Yeah, it's okay to be scared as long as you understand that you can't steer, or you can't control everything that's going to happen to you. Therefore, you can't always be scared of everything, because then you're just going to be paralyzed, and that's sort of where a lot of people end up, right?
That's where I was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and the other part of it, and this is, I mean, again, you and I have talked pretty frankly about this, is I held on to, I held on to the death of my parents as a security blanket, as a built-in excuse for not moving forward, or for not moving laterally.
In your head, was it a matter of, I haven't worked through this yet and I'm not ready to move on, or, well, I can't move on because then I'm letting go of the people who I've lost, and therefore, in my head, somehow that'll mean that they meant less to me, or, you know, some sort of crazy thing like that.
I think there's part of it. I think there's part of it that falls into both areas. I mean, I, you know, the there were times when I started to forget what my mom looked like.
Sure. Yeah.
And then I felt guilty for that.
Sure. Or what they sound like, or what they smelled like.
Yeah. And I felt guilty for not putting enough time into keeping that memory going.
And after enough years, it ends up becoming this strange, nebulous version of the person that they were, because it's sort of like a rock with all the edges rounded off.
Yeah. The details, the core is there.
Yep.
But the details have become smoothed. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this sort of Gaussian blur over the whole thing. And right. I let that. I let that become a crutch, an excuse, a reason to not put myself out there, to not take any chances, to not try any new things. And it became sort of a built-in reason of why things didn't work out the way I wanted them to. You know?
But my only comment on this from the outside and from my own experience is that I find that it's not really, I don't see it as binary, right?
No, it's not binary at all. Right. It can become more black and more white.
Yeah, but you're losing your grip, and it's this gray area. Like, you're never going to get over the death of your parents. You're never going to completely get over self-doubt if you're the kind of person who doubts yourself all the time. You know, it's like, it's sort of this constant battle of, I kind of think of it as like, you know, I go to the gym 5 or 6 days a week. I kind of see it as, I can't stop myself from dying of old age and my body breaking down, but I can do what I can to maintain it in the present. You know, see what I'm saying?
But even then, there's only so much you can do. There's still sort of cause and effect. There's still entropy.
Yep.
And I think at that sort of the inverse apex, that sort of dark place where, and this is a film that we've used quite a bit of over the course of the show. There's the Shawshank, that Get Busy Living or Get Busy Dying. And I think it got to that point where I went, if I stay in this place, and if you're listening, maybe you're in a place like that. Maybe you've been in a place like that. Maybe you're on your way out. Maybe you're on your way in. I don't know. But if I stay in this place, both physically and emotionally, bad things will happen. Or I will limit the amount of good that can happen.
Sure.
And I have to be... I have to be grateful for where I am in order to, I think in order to propel myself to get someplace new.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you believe that there are bad choices in life or just different choices?
You know, I've played that semantic game with myself, you know, for a lot of years. I mean, it's, you know, another sort of thing my mother used to say is, you know, there are no failures. There's just things that don't work out the way you want them to be.
Yeah.
You want them to. And while I get that on this sort of metaphysical level, I've done some things that sure felt like failures.
Sure.
You know, I've done some things.
But hasn't everybody?
Yeah, they have. They sure felt like wrong decisions at the time, you know?
Yeah.
And again, I think it's a, you need to give yourself permission to get out of your own way and see where that goes. I had a preconception of where I thought my life would be by the time I reached 40, by the time I reached 45, but you know, right. Whatever. And it was nowhere near where I thought it would be. Right. But at 48, soon 49, I could not have imagined this place. I could not have imagined, and I don't mean this physical place, although yes, that too. I mean, if you asked me 5 years ago, you know, would I ever live on the East Coast? No. But I think that this place that I'm in now, I could not have seen it coming, but I had to be willing to sort of let go a little bit, not completely let go of the wheel and go, okay, you know, I'm just going to trust that I get there, because that's kind of silly. Or at least in my world, it's kind of silly. It might work for you, but it doesn't work for me.
Well, it's the John Lennon, right? It's the life's what happens while you're making other plans.
Right.
I mean, you can make all the plans you want, and you can go in the direction you think you're going to go in, but ultimately life is going to pull you in a certain way anyway.
Yes. Yes. And I think I got to a point where, you know, I had in my head, I had pissed away so many opportunities. And who knows where those things would have gone, but I had pissed away so many opportunities that there was this sort of realization of, you know, who knows how many chances you get to keep taking chances.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah. And I mean, all this to say, if you are out there struggling with, you know, your life, your family, your friends, your advancing years, whatever it is. Number one, you're not the first person to go through it. But number two, I think it begins and ends, for me at least, it begins and ends with gratitude. You know, I have to be, I have to be conscious of the stupid shit that I complain about.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's, everyone's got things that if you back up for a minute and you thought, this situation could be so much worse. You know, it's like, if something else happened, if suddenly I, you know, was diagnosed with some terrible disease, I'd be very happy with the problems I'm having right now.
Right.
That kind of thing.
There's a documentary on Netflix right now called I Am Not Your Guru. And it's a documentary about Tony Robbins.
Oh, yeah.
And I like Tony Robbins. I think he's coming generally from a good place. He gets a little catchphrasey.
Yep.
But there was one thing that he said over and over in this that I think really rings true, at least for me, and that is, you've got to stop thinking of life as something that happens to you and think of it as something that happens for you.
Hmm. It's not where I thought he was going with that, but okay.
I like that. I like that a lot. You can't. And the idea is that you know, you can't blame life for the bad things that happen and not also sort of thank your life or be grateful for the good things that happen.
Sure.
Anyway.
You know, it's Can I swerve a little bit on the same
theme? Yeah, please. Please. No, we don't do rabbit holes on this show.
We're going to get into an article about Chuck Close in a couple minutes that you and I read this weekend that you really liked. And I was also reading this article on our Photographer of the Week before the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about this idea of there's always this conversation about the people who make stuff being happy or not being happy, right? You know, like the depressed artist or the happy artist, and you don't have to be depressed to be an artist, and you don't have to whatever, you know, all these sort of different pathways people take to explaining how, why, and what an artist is, you know, mm-hmm. you know what I'm mm-hmm. talking about? And I was thinking about it the other day, and while I agree that you certainly do not need to be sad to make art, I also don't know if you need to be happy either, you know, like that there are people of all shapes and sizes and mental types who do what they do with their lives, and it may not make them happy, but it still may be what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
I do. I think. I mean, I would translate that as, at least for myself.
Yep.
You have to be present. And if present means happy, okay. If present means sad, okay.
Yeah.
But you have to be present and take in your life wherever you're at.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, there's plenty of people who have been largely miserable most of their lives. But if you said, would you do anything differently? They said, no way.
This right.
is, you know, so in that way, I feel like there is a certain level of moral judgment and sort of self-righteousness that goes with people who are quote unquote happy with what they do to people who are quote unquote unhappy in their lives, mm-hmm. but still do what they do because they feel that that's what they need, want, or should be doing,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know? And there are certain, I don't know, assessments that are made from the outside. And I feel like for many years it was like, you know, not only you need to do what makes you happy, or the whole like, stop being sad. It's not about being sad to be a good writer, songwriter, or whatever it is. It's like,
right.
well, maybe for that guy, it is. And mm-hmm. why isn't that also perfectly reasonable answer? You know,
it's I like, think I, for some it can be.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
We've talked about this, I think we've talked about the video, but I don't know about this particular thing. Maybe we probably have. Who am I kidding? Of course we have.
We talked for 7,000 hours.
There's the Don McCullen video. Don McCullen, famous photojournalist, who after, you know, a 50-year career of documenting what he calls pain and suffering, realizes that there's no value in it whatsoever, that he's wasted his life doing the thing that sort of gave him the life that he had.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our Photographer of the Week says very similar things.
Very similar. Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess, I mean, there are people for whom they thought that they were living a happy life, and then, you know, like let's say they had all kinds of career and monetary success and they were married and whatever it is. And then they realize when they're 70 years old that wasn't what they wanted after all, or you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. from the outside, it's amazing how external factors have very little to do with happiness.
Well, and
whether they be good or bad external factors, you know,
it's also the perception. The outside, you kind of mentioned this a minute ago, the outside perception of it.
Yeah.
You know, our lives, I mean, I think we are on many levels fairly transparent about what goes on in our lives, but it's still an external perception. It's still, you're still getting a 2 hour a week or hour and a half a week glimpse into, you know.
Right.
The other, however many hours, how many hours are there in a week?
There's another 2 hours in the week.
Fair enough.
But you, you know, yeah, you and I talk a lot about stuff, but there's plenty of stuff we don't talk about.
There's plenty of stuff that we don't talk about. Yeah. And I'm okay with
that. You and I
that.
Know about each other that we don't talk about on
air.
Yeah. Right?
And I'm okay with that. You know, I I don't go into anything without thinking about it. I'm not an impulsive person.
Really?
Yeah.
This is a revelation for the show.
Right.
Stop the presses.
This morning on Tuesday. Yeah. And you're right. There are some things that are below the surface. You see kind of the iceberg, and there's still all that stuff underneath. And I'm okay with that. I don't know. It's fascinating where, not only where we all are, but where we think everyone else is.
Yes. Yeah. And that it infects in some ways how people react to things we say or ask for or whatever. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. whether it's comments we get about the show or people you try to contact to interview or me. There was I needed a tattoo parlor and for a shoot, and I went down. I happened to be walking by this place that looked good, and I walked in and I introduced myself and I was talking to the guy, and he was just very like, oh yeah, well, you know, it costs us a lot of money to run this place, and you know, you don't have a budget and blah, 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 blah. Like a little bit dismissive. And I said, all right, that's fine. He's like, well, you know, send me an email, whatever, and I'll think about it. And I sent him an email with some examples of my work, and all of a sudden he was nice as pie, and we went down there, and he was a total sweetheart. And to me, initially, I was just like, why was the guy kind of weird towards me? But then in hindsight, I think, well, he's just being a little bit protective of
sure.
his time and place. And but then he realized that I was in some way worthy of his time. And
yeah, you know, he could get five of you a week coming in there asking exactly. the same thing. And, you know, some of them are knuckleheads and some of them are great.
Exactly. Like, right.
It's just, ugh. You know,
but
you
initially
know.
I took it as like, wow, why is the guy being such a jerk? What did I do? You know,
right.
But it has nothing to do with me, right. You know? I've been trying to put myself in the mindset of other people around me as much as I can.
As long as they silence their phones when it rains.
Oh God, that drives me crazy. but certainly for people who are reacting to me in some way that I internally either take offense to or are upset about,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, wow, why was that lady such a jerk? Or, you know, I'm surprised that they
said
no to that
price. Are you able
to
do that to yourself? Are you able to go, wow, why was I such a jerk about that?
Oh yeah. And
I find
certainly,
that harder for me. Like, what was going on that I either thought that or said that? Or,
yeah. That's years of therapy, and also to stop and think, wait, why am I reacting to the way that person reacted to me the way I am? And it's
right,
like,
right.
Oh, they hit some nerve that has nothing to do with the guy at the tattoo shop. Not that he did. I'm just using him as an example.
Yeah, sure, sure.
You know, it has nothing to do with him. It's because when I was in the third grade, some guy stole my R2-D2 doll and I'm still upset about it in some way.
Action
whatever.
Figure. Action figure.
Exactly. I did have an R2-D2 stolen from, I do believe.
But it wasn't a doll. It was an action figure.
Actually, I had an R2-D2 action figure, little tiny, the little, whatever, 2-inch ones, you know.
Yeah, like the original ones.
Yeah.
When they were still made by Kenner.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I didn't, I don't think it was stolen, but I did leave it at a friend's house, and Jimmy Joseph, who's my friend on Facebook, and maybe he listened to the show. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Jim.
And I was upset about it for a long time. I was thinking, wow, I never figured out a way to get that R2-D2 back. I always liked the way they felt in the hands, especially the droids of that ilk. Of that generation toy.
Hey, can we put the Serenity Prayer in the notes?
Yeah. In fact,
I will put the
Wikipedia entry.
Yeah.
But there is definitely an element of that, right? It's just like there are things you can control, there are things you can't control, and you just have to get to the point where in your mind you can differentiate between the two.
Yes.
And realize that, you know, a meteor coming from the sky that hits your house wasn't aiming for your house. It was just flying in. It was sent in that trajectory a billion and a half years ago. And you know what I mean? Like certain things are just numbers.
Yeah. I mean, I think we do tend to personalize things.
Mm-hmm.
At least I do.
Yeah.
You know, if you're having a bad day, Bill, and you know this for a fact, if you're having a bad day,
bad days, yeah.
Somehow I did something.
Oh, sure. You know, wait, you or, specifically?
Yeah. Like if we talk and you're having an off day or something and, sure. You know, I'm like, well, shit, what did I do?
Yeah.
You
know? Sure.
You do the same thing.
Sure. It's, like, why is he so cranky today?
Yeah. You know, why do we do that? You know, and
in general, like you and I specifically or people in general?
No, just people in general. I mean, yeah, I think I'm getting better about it.
It's an interesting thing. Can I just say one last thing?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I find myself being more able to dissociate from that kind of thing or to separate myself and say, you know what? I can't make that better. That has nothing to do with me. You know what I'm saying? Like if you're in a cranky mood, for example, just as a thing about something that has nothing to do with me, it's like, well, all the talking I want to do to you to try to get you out of that may not work because it has nothing to do with me. Right. Like, but there is there's part of me that wants to try because I'm somehow in the system.
Right.
Like the system of Jeffrey Sidoris, I am an element of that system as your friend.
Yes.
You know, and it's like there's part of me and that goes for family stuff, that goes for business stuff. It's just like that like I am an ingredient in this dish. And yet, you know, all the salt in the world is not going to make those strawberries better, you know, whatever it is. Right. No. Like it just can't be done.
How many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Just one. But the light bulb has to want to change.
Right. So cheesy. All right, where were you going to go? I thought you were going to
you were going to
twist.
I don't know. I don't know where I was going to go. Right, I will say we got a voicemail from Tom.
Yes.
Who said that I seem much happier since I moved to DC. So thank you for that. I think I am much happier.
Well, that can happen.
Yeah.
The East Coast can do that to you.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for entertaining.
Should we start the show? What episode are we on?
Yeah. 220, yeah. thanks, guys.
Hey, question for you as somebody who knows about paint. Okay. I have some old Testor's flat enamel paints for model making.
Sure, yeah.
How do I get rid of this?
Often...
You're supposed to dispose of it a certain way, I'm sure.
Well, because it's not water-based.
This is nasty stuff.
Yeah. Typically, your city or locale will have like a city yard that you can bring those kinds of things to that they will dispose of it.
I mean, they're the little tiny shot glass bottles, you know, the little tiny ones.
Sure. I had a bunch of it and I went to, I think it was either the city of Upland, might have been the city of Upland, and they disposed of it. There's like a couple days a year where you can bring whatever you want and they will take care of it. But definitely I would not just toss it in a landfill or something like that.
Yeah. Maybe I'll put it out on the front stoop and see if somebody else takes it.
Are they still good? Or
they are probably 30 years old, but they are still wet. They're still liquidy inside.
Okay.
So they're probably still usable, right? Oil paints last forever. Well, I mean, relatively forever. 30 years is not a big deal for oil paints that are well sealed, right?
Right. Yeah, I would.
Pigment's not going anywhere.
You know, somebody might want them. I mean, you could Craigslist it.
Yeah.
I'm sure somebody would want a nice set of paints.
Yeah. Yeah. There's only two of them in a modeling glue pen. You know, have they made those for a while? In fact, I could probably do that.
Modeling glue pen.
It's like a marker that has the modeling glue coming out of it.
Oh, yeah. I just used the tubes. They were orange and white, if memory serves.
Sure. Yeah, classics.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of huffing for a lot of people. Not in a good way. You know what's never a good idea?
Huffing model glue?
Yes.
Right.
Is it because I just watched Airplane recently that joke lands?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
Yeah.
Lloyd Bridges, totally classic.
He pulls out that exact tube that you're talking about, I think.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit amphetamines. Such a great movie.
It's so good. All right, can we get into this Chuck Close thing?
Yeah, sure.
All right, so you read this article.
I did read this.
Okay.
I read it.
It's called The Mysterious Metamorphosis of Chuck Close, and it is an interesting article.
Who took the photo? I couldn't find any photo credit.
Christopher Anderson from Magnum, which I actually like that photo a lot.
I dig that photo a lot.
I also like the group photo of him and his daughters and grandchildren down the bottom.
Oh, there it is. Okay, right there, a little byline.
Very, very good stuff. So, Christopher, if you happen to listen or somebody else knows Christopher, thumbs up. Good job.
Yeah, terrific shot. Terrific shot.
So, for those of the listeners who don't know who Chuck Close is, can you give us a 15-second line about who Chuck Close is?
Well, I mean, he's probably one of the most well-known American artists. Has been successful in both photography and painting.
Yep.
He has been successful in completely reinventing a style that, to my knowledge, certainly popularized it. It may have existed, but he certainly popularized that style in part due to his injury.
Yeah. Although there are arguments against that in the article, which is part of what I'd like to discuss.
Yeah. I think he was probably the first person that I could recognize by name that does this sort of big hyper real portraiture.
Yep.
And it's still, you know, look, I don't know a ton about art, but he's still one of the people that I recognize from a distance seeing his work.
Sure.
And I think that's pretty...
And him, for that matter.
Yeah, and him, for that matter.
Considering
the
prints and the clothes that he wears.
Yeah, yeah.
6 miles away. Hey, it's Chuck Close.
So, I mean, from that standpoint, I don't know a lot about him. I'd love to read more about him in his own words.
Yeah, there's a really great Chuck Close book
mm-hmm.
that I know Craig has because he went to the opening. It's called Chuck Close Work. It's a
okay.
big giant hardcover thing. It's let's see how many pages. It's 370 pages, and it's
on Amazon.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes. It's a 12x14-inch book, almost 400 pages. So it's like a big chunkin' book.
How much is it? $100?
It is $58.
That's not bad.
I'll put a link in the show notes.
All right.
You're right. He did all that very photographic-looking, perfect work back in the early 70s, right? That's like was his original thing in the art world in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And then when was it? In the 80s that he had his fall?
83, maybe?
Okay, so
let's
sometime
see.
In the 80s, he had a... it's 88, actually.
88,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah. He basically collapsed... he was at an art opening on the Upper East Side or something and started feeling weird, walked himself to the hospital and collapsed in the front door of the emergency room or something. And it turned out he had some arterial block or something like that, that in the long run caused him to, he basically had a stroke, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which caused him to
stroke or aneurysm or something.
Aneurysm. Yeah. Something, yeah. Which caused him to lose the ability to basically move the bottom half of his body and mostly his upper body. So he's sort of quadriplegic with a little bit of motion in the hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so has been pushed into a wheelchair for the rest of his time. Although he has one of those super swanky, fancy wheelchairs that could do all kinds of things like climb stairs.
Yeah.
Is that a Dean Kamen one?
I think it is. Yeah. He did use one, a Dean Kamen one to the best of my knowledge for a while. And it was one of the ones where if you were just sort of standing talking to him, it
could
rise
up
and yeah. balance. Yeah. So he would be at your height.
Did I ever tell you the story of the time that I kind of quasi met him?
Him Chuck Close or him
yeah,
Dean Kamen?
Chuck Close.
Mm, no.
I was taking pictures for the University of Chicago of Philip Glass and this PhD physicist. And the two of them were giving a talk, and I had to take some pictures before the talk. And Philip Glass and Chuck Close are good friends, so he invited Chuck Close. And this was the night... I'm going to get a little personal here for a moment. This is the night... I have a niece who's blind. And it happened in utero. She had a bleed in her brain, this hydrocephalus thing. And I got the news about it while I was setting up for this shoot with Philip Glass. And I walked outside to speak to my mother because at the place, the National Arts Club or wherever they were doing the talk, you couldn't bring, I think it was the Players Club, you couldn't talk inside with cell phones. So
right.
I had to go outside and I had like five calls from my mother and my sister. It was like this big deal. And I sat there talking to my mother and my sister about how my niece may never walk, all this kind of stuff. And as I'm hearing this and my stomach's kind of like, all the blood's kind of coming out of my head and huge medical emergency in my family.
Sure.
Chuck Close slowly slides by at like 1 mile an hour, like a foot away from me.
Just like...
Yeah, is just like drives by me as I'm hearing this in my ear. And I'm like... This is so complete. Like, what are the odds, right?
Right,
like,
right.
The guy who has overcome his disabilities more than anybody else, arguably, you know, in the world, is motoring by me as I hear about the possible disabilities of my niece, you know. And when we went inside and he, like, went up the stairs and whatever it is, and it was pretty fascinating. But he is definitely like one of these guys who he shifted the way he does things. His early work, as you said, was almost nearly photographic, right? In these large six by eight inch paintings.
Enormous.
Yeah. And then later he kind of shifted to a more, God, how would you representational style?
Yeah, it's almost it's pixely. It's
grid based, pixel based, like,
yeah, it's a series of diagonal. It's typically a diagonal grid, and each square is its own little sort of mini painting that, when viewed from afar, makes up a portrait.
Yeah, this larger collage. And does he only do portraits? Has he ever done anything else, or is it always just big faces?
To my knowledge, it's just faces.
Yeah, which is also interesting, right? So anyway, he is now much older. What is he, in his 70s or something now? They say in the article, but I can't remember exactly. And he has made all these major changes in his life, where he divorced his first wife. He doesn't talk to his kids all that much. He apparently is spending much of the year down in Miami Beach, some of it up in Long Beach up here on Long Island, outside of where, out near where I lived, out by Kennedy Airport, and has completely sort of changed the way he's living his life in a very strange way, right?
Mm-hmm.
That people are saying, man, what the hell's going through his mind? And so this guy went and did this long series of interviews. Will Hilton went out and did a bunch of interviews with him, which ended up in this article. And there's a number of really good little passages that I thought that you and I would have some fun with.
What, sure. Hit me.
All right. This one's a little long, but I'm going to see where I can go with it, okay?
Okay, yep.
The dirtiest word in art is the C word, Close said. I can't even say craft without feeling dirty. He attributed this change in part to the economic eruption of modern New York. I blame what's happening on how expensive it became to be an artist, he said. When I came to New York in 67, a 2,500 square foot studio was $85. Without access to such large private studios, he said, many young artists have developed alternate ways of working, like drawing plans for an installation or a sculpture they hope to have made, but not actually producing the work until it's selected for a show. It's post-studio art, he said. Sculptors who never seen their work before an exhibition. It's designed on the back of a cocktail napkin at 35,000 feet, and then they build it for the first time in Germany. For an artist who learns to work this way, he added, a studio can become unnecessary, even when one's available. He said, quote, I've been involved for many years with the American Academy in Rome, the most beautiful studios that anybody will ever be offered. And depending on who's on the jury, some years there won't be a single person who makes anything, he said. They just sit in these beautiful studios. They put their work up on the wall that they used to get the grant. And then they just sit there and talk for a year. It's criminal. You can talk in any room. These rooms should be used to make paintings or sculpture. And then out in this post-studio art thing came the absolute scariest notion of all, which is de-skilled art. Have you heard of that? De-skilled? It's like, whatever you do, don't show them you have any facility. All right, so what do you make of that? Because he definitely started, certainly his early work, even more than his current work, was almost entirely skill,
right?
One could say, right? It was like 98% skill.
Yeah, the handling of the brush was remarkable, still is.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I think his skill is just as good. It's in a different way. He is able to work from a foot away and create a painting designed to be viewed from 10 feet away.
Yeah, yeah. He's also, and he has all kinds of stuff where basically the canvas isn't on a regular easel. It's on some kind of motorized easel so he can move it into position so it's right in front of where he needs to paint and that kind of thing. Like, yeah, he has all kinds of...
The transformation of his work, I think, is equally impressive to the transformation of his process in making the work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But to his quote...
Wait, let me give you one more before you comment.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
After his collapse in 1988, he briefly considered shifting to conceptual work himself. Quote, "I'm lying in bed, paralyzed. Now what am I going to do?" he said. "I thought, I can make a work of conceptual art. I could put a level on a shelf as well as anybody." Nice. But I was going to miss the activity of pushing paint around. So pretty soon I thought, I'm going to get the paint on the canvas, even if I have to spit the paint on the canvas.
Mm-hmm.
They found me a room in the basement, an art therapy room. It was so depressing, unfinished baskets hanging from the ceiling because the person had died before they finished the basket, or they gave them wood burning, dot, dot, dot. Hmm. Go ahead. Sorry, didn't mean
well,
to.
Well, it sounds like for him, the making, and that is to say the making by the artist, is core to the meaning of the work.
Paramount.
Yeah. I can't say that I don't agree with that on some level. I mean, using one of the, I think a terrific example of what we're talking about is somebody like Damien Hirst, who has teams of people making his work.
Yeah. He actually references Jeff Koons in the next paragraph.
Right.
We would sit at the long table in the middle of the floor eating East Indian food while discussing the commercial compromise made by artists who rely on assistants to make their work. Quote, "I look at my friend Jeff Koons and I think, why in God's name does he do it like that? Why would you give up the fun part to become the CEO of an art manufacturing company?"
There it is, right? There it is.
Yeah.
So do you want to make art, or do you want to make art?
Capital M, lowercase m?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's
okay. But is there a moral question to that for you?
I don't think there's a moral question for me. I mean,
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I mean, we've talked about Richard Serra.
Sure.
Richard Serra does some of the fabrication and production, yeah, but some of the larger pieces he doesn't.
Yeah.
There's another guy who I like.
To be fair, he actually requires other people to do that because they are 700 ton rolls of steel.
Yeah, but I mean, he's done, like, there are some smaller pieces that, yep, that, you know, Ron Arad is another guy who, you know, does some work, but then from what I understand has some, I don't think it's black and white. I mean, going back to our earlier discussion, I think that there are instances where it can be pushed in one way or the other. For me, the joy is in the making.
Right. Yep.
You know, and I think maybe it's a difference between, I don't know, but I would imagine it's akin to a director versus a DP, you know?
Yeah. Okay.
A DP wants to be the guy holding the camera or behind the camera or setting it, making, yeah, I'll take what you give me in terms of direction, but I want to be the guy that does it.
Yeah.
I think that in, for example, Gregory Crutzen and Rick Sands, I think though they are very collaborative in their relationship, they both have very clear ideas of what their roles are.
Right. In that instance, which role would you rather have?
Well, in talking to both of them,
yeah,
I think theirs is kind of a special relationship in that they do collaborate so deeply,
right,
that they do. I think if you took one of them away from the other, the work would be very different.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, I can see the allure of doing both. I can see the allure of being an art director, and I can see the allure of being the guy or girl sitting in Illustrator doing the work.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that it depends on the project, but certainly for the kind of stuff that Chuck Close does, his hand holding a brush is a big element of that.
Sure. And I think his commentary speaks to not just painting, but we could make that connection to photography as well.
Sure. Yep.
Where you're seeing, in talking to different photographers and in looking at what's happened with Kelby and Creative Live, you're seeing an interest in training.
Yep.
At least on the outside, maybe they're getting it somewhere else, but you're seeing an interest in training drop. You're seeing we're taking more pictures, but we're not learning how to take pictures.
Or we're learning some other way.
Or we're learning some other way. Correct. Correct.
Yeah. I mean that feeling is a lot of why, you know, are there better retouchers than me in the world? Of course there are. There's billions of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not bad at it, but are there better people? Sure. But I like doing the whole process because then I feel like I can have my name on it and not feel like it's.
Sure. You may get to a point where you go, you know what? I want to do this thing, whatever this thing is.
That is beyond me. And I ask somebody
else to help. I don't have
the
chops to do. And right. I need to bring it in. I want to do it. I want to shoot it. Yeah, I want to concept it. I want to get it done. But I need to bring you in to help me.
But even in a situation where I was so busy with commercial work where I didn't have time to do my own post, I would tend to actually take less work so that I could also do the post.
You might.
Just cuz like I just have a I have a need to feel that way, right?
Well, that's part of your output.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a terrific interview with Brooke Shaden, whose work I really like. Mm-hmm. And you know, she takes very, and I don't mean this pejoratively at all, but she takes very basic photographs in parking lots, on her balcony, in her room, and then in Photoshop, in post, that's where she makes them her own. That's the part that she really loves to do. Not that she's not a good photographer, but if you took Photoshop out of her mix,
she wouldn't be making the art she's making.
Correct. Correct. Right. Whereas I think if you took someone, I don't know. Who was the guy that
you take Photoshop away from Dan Winters, it still looks like Dan Winters.
It's still going to look like, that's a great example. It's still going to look like Dan Winters.
Yeah. So can I go on to something?
Yeah, go on. Next one.
Okay. Talking about critics.
Mm-hmm.
When Hilton Kramer was the critic at the Times, he reviewed my first big show. He took half a page to say how awful it was, and I still remember the quote. He said, What Mr. Close makes is evidence of the kind of crap that washed ashore when the tide of pop art went out. He said, isn't that great? And the guy said,
that's a great quote.
It's brutal. And he says, no, it's great. He said again, if Hilton Kramer liked my work, I would slit my wrists. John Cannaday hated me too. Deborah Solomon doesn't speak to me anymore because I was at a cocktail party and she had just written a profile of someone that was so nasty. And I said, I don't know how you live with yourself. It's like being a meter maid. All you do is bring people misery.
Wow.
He pulled no punches in this thing. It's like some of the quotes are really great.
Yeah.
I do like the idea that as you get more public about the work that you make, mm-hmm. and you find that certain people don't like your work or are more critical of your work, that is actually just something of a growing pain. Because the more people who see your work, the more people there are who aren't going to like it for whatever reason. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, no matter how good you are, there's going to be a critic who pans the movie or whatever.
Do you... Okay, if you're not going to look at the bad critiques, is it fair to look at the glowing reviews?
No, I what I'm saying is that like you need to take everything with a grain of salt. The glowing the glowing reviews need to be taken with a grain of salt, and the ones that say things like, you know, the kind of crap that washed ashore when the tide of pop art went out. As somebody who is largely unimpressed with pop art as a general movement, I'm glad of the stuff that came in the 70s post pop art personally. You know what I mean? So like I can understand where Chuck Close is coming from when he's just like, that's fine that they don't like me, because their whole way of looking at art is the opposite of the way I look at it, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that's all right. We're on opposite sides of this battle or whatever.
I wonder what those same people would say about the work.
What
now.
Do you think of me now, huh?
not from a standpoint of not from that standpoint, but has the art world caught up to the curve that he was on.
Or has his move away from the photorealism into the more abstract brought him more in line with the desires of,
yeah, maybe,
of the other people?
Maybe it was that period in his life, that period in his work that didn't ring true to them.
Right.
I look at that work and I'm fascinated by photorealistic work.
I am too.
Is it art? Well, to me it is. I don't know if it's art to the art establishment, but I think there's art in the process of doing it. I think it moves me. I think it evokes an emotional response.
Yeah. Do you find it interesting that, okay, humans have not evolved much in the last, 10,000 years, right? Mm-hmm. We're pretty much how we were 10,000 years ago. Why is it today there are the kids who can draw a Coke can on a piece of paper that looks like a Coke can, like freakishly so? You know, these like videos online.
Mm-hmm.
Or people like Chuck Close who can take that photograph and mimic it 6 feet tall to the point where you go up and you look at it and you go, that's not made by human hands. It looks like a facsimile, right?
Right. It's that, what was that, the next Rembrandt, the thing that we talked about a few weeks
right,
ago?
Right. Yeah. But at the same time, people weren't doing that 100 years ago. I don't know of any 1870 illustrator, painter person who made things that looked exactly like photographs. Right? Like, did it take...
Maybe it wasn't the goal aesthetically.
Right, but there wasn't some guy who was just slightly on the autistic spectrum who that's what he did and made it because he was so freakishly good at making things that look like reality. You know what I mean? I'm surprised that never came out.
Maybe there was, but it just didn't.
Yeah, that's a good question. Just never caught on.
Look at some of the engravings that we saw at the print show.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, they were hundreds of years ago, not thousands, but...
Yeah, some of those are pretty great, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
We watched Twister the other day.
Oh, great flick.
Yeah. So we watched Twister. I don't know why it came up, but Conrad was like, I want to watch Twister. Find it. And I was like, so we watched Twister.
Phil Hoffman as Dusty. Loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of the effects are still fine for 1996 standards, right? Like they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the tornado effects are pretty bad. Like some of the stuff flying through the air and that kind of stuff, right?
But at the time,
right, those were state of the art, right?
Yeah.
And well, now,
look, go back to young Sherlock Holmes, the stained glass monster.
Right. That was like the first one.
People in the effects community couldn't figure out how they did it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Couldn't figure it out.
But I wonder if it was a limitation of the technology, like their renderers just weren't good enough to get the light on the cows that fly by the window, right? Mm-hmm. Or if they just didn't see the light on the cows being at the level that we would do it today.
Yeah. Or is it a combination of both?
Or a combination of both. Yeah. And that rolls back into this photorealism thing. It's like maybe they're just, somebody hadn't done it. Like it required 100 years of mechanized printing of photographs and people seeing that all the time for some guy to even think in his head, I can recreate that with a pen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is just a really strange idea to me. But interesting. All right, on artist block, I've never had an artist block before. If I just get to work, it'll happen. What is his famous quote? There's that famous Chuck Close quote. Can you look it up while I read this?
Sure.
About work and, shut up, real pros work or something like that. But I worked on a painting in Long Beach after my last show, and I just sat there confused. I didn't have any idea what I was doing, so I quit that painting and backed up and hoped a change in the venue would make it happen. There's a social disconnect, an emotional disconnect sometimes. I don't think any of us, even in our real family, in our family really, can put a finger on it. Could you be happy if the block doesn't go away, I asked. And he said, I wouldn't want to.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah, the quote is, I don't work with inspiration. Inspiration is for amateurs. I just get to work.
There you go. That's the one.
It kind of echoes the Picasso quote is, something inspiration, it just needs to find you working.
Right.
Inspiration is everywhere. It just needs to find you working.
Yeah, yeah. This kind of goes back to our initial conversation, right? Like, what if writer block doesn't go away? Could you still be happy after that? And he's like, I wouldn't want to be happy after that. Like, I don't want to give up on the promise of coming up with a new idea.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and he goes in to talk about Paul Simon, because apparently Paul Simon used a Chuck Close painting for his new album cover. Did you know that?
I'm not really a big Paul Simon fan, so I don't really know.
Apparently it is a something. Oh yeah, it is a Chuck Close painting. Look at that. Yeah, wow, that's really creepy. And he heard that Paul Simon has sort of announced his retirement, and apparently he, it says 3 weeks earlier, Simon had released a new album, Stranger to Stranger, with its album cover taken from a portrait that Chuck Close painted of the musician a few years back. Then the day before I saw Close, Simon announced that the album would be his last. I called him up and I said, "Artists don't retire," Close told me. I think I talked him out of it. I said, "Don't deny yourself this late stage, because the late stage could be really interesting. You know, everyone hated late de Kooning, but it turned out to be great stuff. Late Picasso? Nobody liked it. Turned out to be great." And Paul said, "I don't have any ideas." And I said, "Well, of course you don't have any ideas. Sitting around waiting for an idea is the worst thing you can do. All ideas come out of the work itself."
Yeah. Well, that's
echoing the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's inspiration exists, but it has to find you working.
Yeah. Do you think Paul Simon, I mean, music that you've heard of Paul Simon's over the past 10 years, do you find it all uninteresting?
Of the music that I have heard, it doesn't really do much for me.
Is there a twilight in the, is there part of a life cycle of the life of an artist where it's time to put down the pen or the camera, you know?
I think there are certainly periods that you resonate with more. I mean, look at some of his contemporaries. Maybe James Taylor would be one. Sure. Yeah. While his stuff is certainly good now, and he's a fantastic guitarist, the Sweet Baby James era work clicks with me more.
Sure. Okay.
That's not to say that the work is not great now or interesting or... You know,
Do you think artists can retire? Do you think that's a thing?
I think they can stop making work, sure.
Stop making work publicly.
Yeah. I mean, somebody like Robert Plant.
Yeah.
I think Robert is doing arguably more interesting work now than he did with Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. Rolling Stones are on tour more now than they were for 20 years ago.
Yeah. Artists, I mean, it depends on if you have anything to say. I guess
there are some younger people I know, at least in my friends in the dance world, who are just like, look, all these older people need to retire so that new young dancers can come in. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but
like,
that's kind of
people
a shit,
hold on
that's
long,
kind of a
too
shit
long?
Way to look at it, personally. You know, you need to retire to make room for me. Well,
not necessarily for me. Maybe they're some of the people who are going to retire, you know.
Yeah, but maybe they still have something to say.
Yeah.
Maybe they still have something. Maybe they enjoy it. And if they enjoy it and there's an audience for it, then why not?
Yeah. Yeah. Overall, in this interview, there is definitely a sense that Chuck feels like he's reaching the end of his life, right? Or in the last chapter of his life. And he's changing all of these things in his life, you know, got rid of his divorced his first wife. I apparently got married to that other woman, artist, black, very pretty. She was from Alaska, I think. And apparently he broke up with her. Now he's with some other woman. Apparently he's have dalliances with all these young girls. He doesn't sound happy. You know, he sounds like he's looking for happiness, even with all of the success.
I don't know. Based on this article, it doesn't sound like he really wants to be happy.
Yeah.
Based solely on this article.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of where I was coming from when we were discussing it earlier, like the whole idea of what if he just likes making his work and he doesn't need to find happiness? Or do you think that's always a cop-out?
I can't say where anybody else is at. You know, going back to the very beginning, I think that you have to figure out who you want to be, what's important, what's not important. You know, save all the stuff that's important, get rid of all the stuff that's not. You know, when I moved across country, I did the whole, you know, I measured out my car and put a masking tape square in the middle of my living room, and what fit in the masking tape square came with me, and what didn't went away. Mm-hmm. And I think you can do the same thing emotionally. I think you can do the same thing creatively. I don't know.
Something goes out.
Yeah, you're in different seasons of your life. You know, I think the season that I'm in right now in my life is a happiness that I didn't know I was capable of.
Right.
For any sustained period.
Yeah. Happiness or satisfaction?
Both.
Contentment.
Yes.
Right.
You know, I feel like there has been this block of energy that I have expended over and over, you know, that around self-worth and do I deserve love and do I deserve happiness and do I deserve to be loved or give love or whatever it is, that's something that I have expended energy on my entire adult life.
Right.
And to not have to expend at least as much energy on that has opened up. There are new tributaries flowing through me, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like there are new things bubbling to the surface, whether that's, you know, in the work or in just the way I see the world around me or the way I experience the world around me. But I think you've got to choose, you know? And going back to that, to what I said before, I think you have to realize that choosing not to decide is still choosing. Choosing not to go anywhere, not to do anything, not to move in one direction or another, that's still a choice.
Right. Yeah. So you're making a choice whether or not you're trying to make a choice, so you might as well make a choice.
You might as well.
Yeah.
You know, because again, you don't know how many chances you've got left.
That's true.
You don't know how many, you know, statistically, only statistically, there are more days behind you and I than there are in front of us.
Yep.
And, you know, there are all these cliches. You're not ready to hear it until you're ready to hear it. Going back to being, you know, let Jesus take the wheel, whatever it is.
Sure.
But you still have to make some choices. And I personally put off making choices. I shrouded myself in reasons why I didn't have to make choices.
Sure.
You know, and for Chuck, gosh, you know, at some point he's going to be faced with, am I doing these things for the right reasons? Am I even aware that I'm doing them?
Well, that's the thing that I love about this is that, like, this guy has all of the success that any artist who's listening to this right now could ever want.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yet none of it seems like anything that's actually making him happy.
It doesn't seem to be. And maybe he is.
Yeah.
Maybe he is. Yeah. I mean, he says in one paragraph here, he says, you see, I can't say I'm happier than I've ever been in my life without saying that my relationship with their mother did not make me happy or my children did not make me happy.
Right.
You would think that by now they would just want me to be happy.
Right. You know, it's yeah, all of the success in the world, right?
Yeah,
doesn't guarantee anything.
No,
you know, you have to be happy with where you're at already because you're probably still better off than, you know, most of the people who are also trying to do what you're doing.
You know, and success is a tough one. Success is a tough one to define.
Yeah,
it's a tough one to reconcile. It's a tough one to, you know, because it's a moving target.
Yeah.
What I wanted in my 20s is very different than what I want right now.
Sure. Yeah. There are plenty of people who are starting podcasts that would love the listenership you and I have, right?
Yeah.
Or we look at other people and go, why don't we have the listenership that they have?
Right.
Right?
Right.
But you're going to do that across the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, relationships that you're in or money you have or apartments you live in or, you know, yeah, got to be happy with what you have. Speaking of being happy with what you have, Jeffrey.
Yes, sir.
I know that this software scares the crap out of me.
I thought it might.
I don't like it.
I thought that it might. We are switching gears. If you have comments or questions or you want to chime in on what we have been discussing, podcast it on takingpictures.com. We would sure love to hear from you. Yep. Twitter or Instagram, probably Twitter to get a hold of, at Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris. It's E-R-Y. We would love to hear from you because, you know, let's face it, we're all trying to get through all of this. Anyway, so I found this. I don't even know where this came up, Bill. It came up in one of the feeds somewhere. Piece of software called Landscape Pro.
Same company makes something called Portrait Pro, apparently.
Right.
Which has Editor's Choice 5-star review on Macworld Digital Photo Gold Award.
Yeah. So, Landscape Pro. Bill, it is a new way to enhance your landscape pictures. With intelligent controls that adapt to the features in your photo, Landscape Pro allows you to get...
What was wrong with the old way?
I don't know.
Okay.
Basically, what would you say? This software allows you to manufacture and relight the landscape differently than the way you saw it.
Yeah. So some of the stuff that it's doing are pretty straightforward things like... swapping out skies, things that you could do in Photoshop with certain level of skill that it sort of does automatically. Mm-hmm. It also looks like it analyzes things to figure out what is sky, what is ground, what is water, so that you can target different objects and elements in the frame automatically just by sliding sliders. It kind of reminds me of... imagine if Lightroom or Aperture or the new Mac Photos app just had a slider that was like sky up or down, sky saturation up, you know, as opposed to having to mask it in and do things manually. But it is like filters on steroids.
It's pretty wild. And
the cool thing is the way it does 3D mapping. It basically creates a 3D map of the landscape so that it can do
like
lighting
a height
effects.
Map. Yes.
Yeah.
One of the other things that I thought was fascinating was when you do drop in a new sky, for example, it relights the existing landscape to reflect the conditions of the sky.
Right. So if the sky was blue, it changes the reflections on water.
Yeah. But even to the point where it's going to change or simulate the change in specularity,
yep.
in shadow density, it's kind of fascinating, but it's kind of terrifying.
Well, it's cool tech, right? I mean, whoever did this look, it's not perfect, but these look pretty darn good.
Yeah.
This looks way better than, I was looking at the Portrait Pro, the other app that they make. And, I find the quality of the work that this thing was doing better than the quality of the work that Portrait Pro was doing, in my opinion. But there is, it's, when does something go from being a tool to being a partner or being a crutch or being,
I don't know, because when I look at this, one of the first things that I thought about when I saw this was, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Right.
Which is a terrific film.
You mean the toning?
Yeah, the toning. Sure. If you look at there's a great behind the scenes. I'll find it and I'll send it to you before the end of the show. Yep. Showing what they shot versus what you saw on screen, and in so many of the shots, it was a dramatic difference.
Yeah.
I guess I wonder, to your point, where do you draw the line? And does it cease to be a photograph and be something else?
Yeah, but what is that something else?
I don't know.
I mean, like, there's, like, look, even some of the stuff that I make, you could call a photo illustration. You know what I mean?
Sure.
If you want to say that. But there are certain things that are most certainly photo illustrations. Brooke, what's her name that you like? Shaden.
Brooke Shaden. Yeah.
I mean, those are very much photo illustrations to me.
Yeah.
More than they are.
Robbie Cavanaugh is another one.
Yep. Yep.
What's the other one who does the fantastic costumes? Kirstie Mitchell.
Sure.
Kirstie yeah. Mitchell does.
I mean, even in your interview with Carl Taylor, he has a seems to have a very hard view on what he sees as a photograph.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true.
He's almost a little too far on the conservative end, in my opinion, compared to my view of it, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then there are people who say, well, you know what? Get out of the way, old man. Like, you know, to you, I, and Carl. You know what I mean? Like, this is if this allows me to create my vision, well, the hell with you. Why should I be limited by that?
Right.
I still find it weird, though. I don't know.
I mean, you're right, though. Cool tech, right? I mean, it's
great tech.
It is pretty fascinating. So Landscape Pro, it's, what is it? Standard edition is on sale right now for $39. The Studio Edition, which, let's see, works on RAW and DNG, reads and writes TIFFs at 16-bit, conversion of color spaces, works as a Photoshop plugin, works as a Photoshop Elements plugin, works as a Lightroom plugin.
Yeah.
$59 for that.
Oh, speaking of which, apparently I just got an email a little earlier that Affinity Photo 1.5 is out.
I just saw that. Now, is it
$39?
Is it out in beta or they're out?
Until July, I think it's out. I just got to take a look at it. Affinity Photo V1.5.
Yeah, that's cool. I love it. I've been using it on my book.
The photo, not the you've been using both.
Oh, wait, which one is?
This is Photo, not Designer.
Oh, okay. No, I don't, I use Designer on the book.
But apparently the new Photo one is out.
So Designer has got to be following not soon or not too far behind.
Maybe, I don't know. Is there lots of things you're missing in it?
There aren't lots of things. There are little things. Connecting curves, the endpoints of curves, arrowheads on lines. I mean, just off the top of my head. Yeah. But then there are things that it does where you kind of go, well, why doesn't Illustrator do that? Getting a real-time preview of gradients, for example.
Sure.
Or live Bezier, or not Bezier, live Boolean actions.
Okay, sure.
You know, good stuff, you know, though. I mean, it's
just that and the other thing.
Yeah, hopefully a Designer 1.5 will be not too long.
I still don't know. I put a link to Painting with Pixels, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou thing on YouTube, which they show before and afters.
Yes, yes.
Yep.
But similar kind of thing, right? Where it's very dramatic color grading and dropping in clouds and...
Yep. Speaking of weird photo manipulation thing, can we just do a quick drive-by on this Russian stuff?
Yes.
During the flight, Malaysia Flight 17 that got blown up over the Ukraine, shot down over the Ukraine.
Right.
Russia put out some images, satellite images that were proving that it was actually the Ukrainians who were at fault and not them at all. You know, this kind of thing. Similar in feel to the, what's his name? Colin Powell going up in front of the UN, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then some people did some analysis on some of these photos and realized looking at chroma and color data in them that they were manipulated.
Right.
That things were moved, elements were sharpened, or they don't know, maybe they were replaced with something else and who knows. The point is they were definitely not just sitting there as they were straight out of the computer.
So I guess my question is, what are they hiding?
Well, yes. A, what are they hiding? And B, like, isn't this the one place that there should be no photo manipulation? I mean, this is George Orwell kind of stuff, mm-hmm. right? Like, no, that's not where the tanks were. The tanks were over here and I can prove it by this photograph, even though this photograph is doctored.
It's right.
Like, that gets into some, we have had discussions about, oh, what happens if this war photographer moves the balloon out of the way? You know, this is what happens is that arguably thousands of people may die in a war because of manipulation of images.
Right.
You know, this is on another level. And you know, not for nothing, but between all this like cheating at the Olympic stuff too, it's like, what are the Russians doing? Guys, you're good. You're fine. You know, like, don't say anything at all if you can't actually prove it. Scary.
Yeah, it's really odd.
Yeah, I'll put some links in the show notes, one that I put up and one that Jeffrey found of the actual images, and you can kind of look at what they see are the issues and things that had changed and whatnot.
I mean, it is fascinating in that, you know, we've taken something that for so long has been considered empirical evidence of truth.
Photographs.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, look, what was the show at the Met that we all talked about? Remember the one with the cat, the woman's face with the cat, the whole thing?
Faking It.
Right. So, I mean, it's not like manipulation of photographs is entirely new, but it is now easy enough that it's not done just for artistic purposes. It's being done for, and not even straight propaganda purposes, like, oh, look at this guy up on a horse, whatever. But this is like you're blaming other people based upon doctored photographs. That's like, mm-hmm. that's fraud,
mm-hmm.
not just propaganda, you know?
Yeah, it's not just bad form.
Yeah, right. Like, right. That's actual damage to other people.
Right.
I just think it's kind of messed up that it's gone that far. And then they get caught, and apparently it doesn't make a difference, you know, or whatever. Like, will anybody really notice this? Or is this too esoteric and people go, eh, whatever. You know, I right. hope that people don't, but I wouldn't be surprised if people do. Sad.
Yeah. Well, you know, what are you going to do?
I'm going to start doctoring my photos.
You're going to start?
But it's cute. I like that. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the assignment from last week. Let me pull that one up. I didn't get a chance to look this morning at the latest ones.
Okay.
Oh, forgotten. Yep. Yep.
OTP community.
Forgotten is sad.
You think?
The idea of something being forgotten.
I think there are so many really interesting shots here. Waller's shot of the books.
Oh, no. It's not. I'm not saying there aren't good or interesting shots here. I just, the concept of something being forgotten is sad to me.
Mm-hmm. There was one particular photograph that was, oh man, let me find it because I want to get whoever.
Chris Connor's whoever. Picture of this chimney. I think he was up in the woods making moonshine. How awesome would it be? Couldn't you see Chris Connors make a moonshine?
I kind of could. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's mixing it. He's putting it in vodka bottles at the restaurant.
Right. Right. There was one picture. I'm scrolling through. God, there were a lot of good ones. It was a black and white. Oh, it was the guy.
The old man, Jason's yes. picture. The old guy outside the mall entrance.
Yes.
Yeah, Jason Hill, Oshevsky?
Yeah.
Oshevsky.
Gosh, where is it? Oh, there it is. Yeah, Jason. Oh, man, is that a... That's just...
God, that's my nightmare scenario right there.
It's heart-wrenching, but it's a... You know, this is akin to that the blind photo.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
You know? Some good stuff. Johan... What do you got there? With
interestingly,
smartphones, Pokemon, all is forgotten.
a lot of pictures of homeless or street people, or there's a number of them in here.
Is it forgotten or is that ignored?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was about to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. All right, so what are we doing for this
Jason,
week?
Jason Smith from Trajectory. I like that. We talked about that last time.
Oh,
that
lighthouse.
Yeah, telephone, another one from Waller.
I don't like that Waller guy.
Kent Miller, Philip Hill, forgot a password. Yeah, boy, we've all done that, right? Yeah, one password, that's your source, right? Or LastPass, Bill's a big fan of LastPass.
I am a big fan of LastPass.
So, get a password manager.
Oh, Kent.
Ken Robertson. What is that? Is that Salton Sea? It is Salton Sea.
People love the Sultan. It's an interesting place that people take pictures, considering it's such a pain in the neck to get there.
It is in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. It's not like it's on the way to anything.
No, it's not, unless you happen to be going to Nyland for the weekend. But why would you go to Nyland for the weekend?
Where's Nyland?
It's out by there. It's where the train, there's a train that used to go across the river, which is now, or across the lake, which is there are portions of the lake where you can actually see the train still down there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm going to have to look up this. Oh, Nyland. That's still a place people would go to?
I don't know why you would go there.
Yeah, because there's not really anything out there.
Uh-uh.
God, it's kind of creepy. I'll tell you, the time I spent at Bombay Beach was creepy. I wanted to get out of there as fast as possible.
Like, it is very weird.
It made me feel uncomfortable being there.
Yeah, the beach sort of made of fish scales and fish bones and bird
like
bones.
I felt like, you know, zombies were going to come out of nowhere.
Did you guys ever make it to Salvation Mountain?
Where's that?
That's actually in Nyland. That's the only reason you would go to Nyland.
I did not go that far out. I went to Bombay and turned around.
Yeah. Fearing for your life.
Yeah. It was actually, Conrad was working, so I got to, I see. It's like, there's this crazy thing up in the mountains.
Yeah.
That is weird.
One guy built this thing.
There's always one guy who builds things. It's like that Tinker Town outside of Santa Fe, Albuquerque.
Right.
The whole fascinating, like, one guy who gets obsessive and starts building things in the middle of nowhere thing, it always cracks me up.
There is, speaking of which, there's an app that I would like to recommend. It is called Great Big Story. It's an iPhone app. I'm not sure if it's on Android. I would imagine that it is. Great Big Story is kind of an autonomous news unit, lifestyle kind of thing, funded by CNN.
Oh, okay.
And the app is a series of these little videos, okay? And 2 minutes long, 3 minutes long, and they're just terrific. But there was one in there about a guy who has been building a cathedral by hand.
It's in
human condition. It's called The Lone Man Building a Cathedral. Wait, I just started it. Stop.
Is a man building a cathedral right in front of you?
Not in front of me. Stop in Spain. I think it's in Spain. But he's like 90 something years old. But they are just, they're these bite-sized little pieces. They're all interesting, at least all of the ones that I've watched. And they're, you know, 2, 3, 4 minutes long. So you can get this little bit. And then if you'd want to, you know, you want to go search more and look for more detail, you can. But
sure,
some of them are just terrific. So Great Big Story.
I put a link in the show notes.
All right.
What's our assignment for this week?
There's so much stuff going on in the world. What about newsworthy?
Sure.
Is that too?
Hashtag plagiarism. What?
Wait, why is that plagiarism? Saying newsworthy?
No. Have you read the news this morning?
What news?
Oh, just apparently Trump's wife's speech.
Oh, the Melania. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was pretty funny. There's a video. In fact, I retweeted it. There's a video showing
of the two of them synced up.
The two of them kind of cut together. And it's so funny.
If you're going to choose somebody's words, don't choose the wife of the guy who's whatever. I'm not even going to get into it.
Yeah. Don't choose the guy whose wife it is you're trying to take the job from.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was 8 years ago. That everyone knew because she's a very well-known, very well-respected person, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever. I'm not going to dive into the politics of it. It's just dumb.
At least they got Chachi.
Oh, my God. Did you see him up there?
Yes. America. Americans. Americans for Americans. America for Americans. America. And in closing...
How did Scott Baio fall so far?
Well, I'm surprised I don't know. How did they get him? Did they not see the avocado commercial he did for the Super Bowl? Come on.
Yeah. What's his name? My buddy Dave Hill.
Is he there?
No. But he did write somewhere. God, he wrote something about Chachi, where he's just like, you know, he's like, Chachi hated me before it was cool, or something like, you know, some kind of thing about. Oh, it's so sad. Oh, well, what are you gonna do? Newsworthy.
I mean, was what? Was Greg Evigan busy?
I don't know. It's just bad.
I mean, who? How do you? No offense, because I like Greg Evigan. I was a big BJ and the Bear fan, but still.
Yeah. You can't win, Jeffrey.
I just can't.
Just let it go.
I got to let it go.
I want to mention before we get to our photographer of the week, because a lot of people will turn it off, that Sunday.
Wait,
Sunday,
a lot of people turn off at the photographer of the week?
Well, I'm saying that maybe people get to the end of photographer of the week and they don't listen to us talk at the end and they will miss the announcement about Sunday in New York City.
What is Sunday in New York City?
Sunday is the, isn't this Sunday the, that we're going to go to the Met Brewer, a bunch of us. This Sunday.
The Met Brewery.
The Met Brewer.
Which is the Arbus thing. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I was like, wait, there's a, well, of course there'd be a brewery because Freddie's involved.
We're going to go see the Dean Arbus early work show at the Met Brewer. But a bunch of us were going to meet up at noon beforehand for Lobster at the Red Hook Lobster Pound down near Houston. And I will we'll put a link in the group. And in the show notes. And if you're interested in meeting us there, we're going to meet at noon and then we'll probably end up at the other thing. What, at like two probably? That's probably safe. We'll meet up at the Met up there, which is actually the old Whitney building, and go see some Arbus. And then some people are breaking off after that and doing a photo walk, which is unrelated to us, but looks like fun for people who are into photo walks and I have a dinner obligation, but yeah, so we're going to meet for lunch and eat lobster rolls.
Obligation, not application.
Like, where's that dinner application? I'm hungry. It's on page 73, food. Anyway, just put that out there. Who's our photographer of the week?
Photographer of the week, Ed Cachy.
Come on, do it in the French voice.
Edouard Cachy. Hello, my name is Ed Cachy. I'm a, how you say, photojournalist.
Yeah. Been around for a long time.
I don't know where I saw this. It probably came up on Instagram. I think I follow somebody that, I don't know. But man, I was blown away. I've got this thing about photojournalism that good photojournalism, man, just hits me. Absolutely hits me. And there's a terrific Time article with Ed, and there's a film in it called It's What I Do. Heartbreaking, some of the things these guys and girls witness around the world, and the amount of the degree of harm's way in which they put themselves to document the things that they feel are important is absolutely,
and a lot of times
amazing.
It's not physical harm's way, but emotional harm's way too.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things that Ed touches on in this article. He writes, "Yes, I have two. You know, let me make sure this is the right. Where am I at? Yeah, I have two beautiful and incredible children that are my lifeblood." And a mate who gives love and commitment unconditionally. But most of the time, I'm alone, perfecting my disappearing act. The result is a deep sense of loneliness and abject uncertainty. I've been exposed to pain, suffering, violence, and death, the cumulative effects of which have poisted me into voids of nothingness more often than I could ever have imagined, and more often than my wife deserves to have to live with.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is one of the most honest accounts of being a photojournalist that I've read.
I think it just shows that, you know, all of the decision stuff we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
There is a cost to almost every decision. No, scratch that. There is a cost to every decision.
Yeah. He goes on. I'm also disturbed by how every re-entry into my personal life with friends, family, and colleagues invariably begins with questions that I have come to dread. How long are you home for this time? Or where did you just return from? Or where are you going next?
Right.
While they are innocent enough questions, they reinforce my sense of alienation. Even those closest to me always expect me to be gone, absent, disappeared. Yeah.
And I would imagine that his friends and family who are asking those questions are honestly trying to reconnect with somebody who has been, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You've been away. Where have you been? Let's start redoing this. But to him, it's just a reminder of the fact that he has been away.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is such an, it's an honest account, at least to my eyes and ears. And I am fascinated by it. And I think partially because I feel like either through choice or through circumstance, I've spent the bulk of my life alone.
Sure.
And there are those feelings of, you know, what am I doing?
Yeah. Yep.
So the article is called The Unspoken Consequences of a Photojournalist's Life. And it is by Ed Cash. He was posted back in April, but a terrific read. And then his
fascinating
site. Yeah.
Article. Yeah.
His good stuff. I mean, really good stuff. And not always just, you know, horror and murder and war and sure. That kind of thing. Just there are some beautiful photo essays. I love this kind of work. If I had the emotional wherewithal to deal with it, this is the kind of work I'd love to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think I could do it.
You know, I am not always the biggest fan of documentary photography because mm-hmm. I think part of it is that it is often tugging at your heartstrings, and I know that I'm easily tugged.
Yeah.
But I have nothing but immense respect for the people who do it because I think it is a sacrifice for the greater good. Because I think it's a very difficult thing.
Yeah. I mean, and whether you're talking about physical harm's way that they put themselves in or emotional harm's way.
Right.
Because
right.
You're witnessing some of this stuff over yep. and over and over.
Totally.
Man, it's a tough job.
Yeah.
And to see, this is one of the other things that I have a hard time connecting with is you're finding... Or you're trying to find something beautiful. You're trying to find something compelling. You're trying to find something engaging and fighting against some of the most horrific sides of humanity in order to get to those things.
Yeah, yeah. And trying to follow the rules of composition to make something that looks yeah, interesting right. all while doing that, you know. It's not just what's in front of your lens. It's making what's in front of your lens look visually interesting.
Right.
To get the point across.
Yeah. Fantastic work, though. Love this. So Ed Cashi, what do you think?
I think these are amazing. He's one of those. God, some of these pictures, some of this stuff almost doesn't feel like it almost feels in its humanity, it almost feels inhuman at times. Some of the pictures, you
know. On his site under photo essays, go down to Northern Nigeria. That set of photographs is incredible.
Yeah. This is one of the places I do not want to live.
Right. Yeah.
It's crazy the things that people do to each other, isn't it? It just, it's almost, it's upsetting.
Yeah. It is.
Well, on that positive note,
right.
What, podcast at ontakingpictures.com. You want to leave us a voicemail, 347-687-9411. We always like that. And at Bill Wadman, at Jeffrey Sidoris on the different Instagram-y, Twitter-y things. Not on Pokemon Go. Are you on Pokemon Go? Is that Jeffrey Sidoris?
Jesus, no. I don't get it. I don't get it. It's okay. I mean, I think it's fantastic that Nintendo's stock went through the roof. Yeah. Who knew?
Well, yeah.
I honestly don't think they did. I really don't think they knew that it was going to be this big.
No. I mean, they based probably thought it would be big, but like, you know, people say, oh, how could they let it? It's just like, well, how the hell are you going to account for all of that? You think it might be 50,000 people, it might be 500,000 people, and it might be 5 million people. Well, you go probably for the middle, right? You know, like, oh, well, let's assume that it's 500,000 people are going to be on it. And then instead of 5 million, it's 50 million or whatever. And then you're like, oh, you know, now we're two orders of magnitude out versus right. one order of magnitude.
But I mean, based on some of the decisions that Nintendo's made in the gaming space over the past couple of years, I really don't think that they saw this coming.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, they licensed it to somebody who licensed it to somebody who licensed it to, you know, blah, yeah. blah, blah.
Yeah.
I don't think they're doing as well as they think that they're doing.
Yeah, I mean,
the Nintendo isn't getting as much out of it as everyone seems to act like they're getting out of it. I think Nintendo's getting 10 or 20% of the money. You know, Apple's getting more money than that, you know?
Yeah. The statistics, their stock is up, Jesus, what was it? 10% over the right. couple days.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good stuff though.
So no, I am not on the,
Pikachu. I don't know what that means, but it's one of the things. Pika Pika. I don't know.
Pika Pika. That's the Little Caesars thing, right?
Pika, no.
That's Pizza Pizza.
Pizza Pizza. I do, however, think that the theme song to Back to Work with Merlin Mann and Dan Benjamin on this network is called Pika Pika. And I wonder if it's a reference to Pokemon. Just putting that out there.
I don't know. I know the kids dig it. The stock went from 21,800 yen to 31,700 yen. That's
which
pretty
is a
good.
Lot of yen.
Yeah.
I've heard of that.
You know.
We'll talk to you later, Jeffrey.
All right. Have a good week, everyone. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends.
Yep. We like friends.
We like friends.
Jeffrey needs friends.
I do need friends.
To buy him a graphics card.
Ugh.
Look, if you guys are going to buy one for Jeffrey, just buy one for me.
Yeah, but I
might as well. Why buy one? You wouldn't get two for double.
I need to write
cost.
A strongly worded letter to Fuji and see if they will send me an XT2 for my birthday.
I'm sure they'll get right on that.
You think they'll get right on that?
Yeah. I'm sure you'll make that happen. I'll talk to you later, Jeffrey.
All right. Have a good one.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. It's plain to see something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say.